This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're discussing Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, chapters 11 and 12, The Bribe and Magic is Might. In these chapters, you know, Lupin has a bit of a meltdown.
Yes, he does. I mean, for good reason, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. He's got a lot going on right now.
Yes, he does. He does.
Like our buddy Morgan. A lot going on.
Oh, yes. Poor Morgan.
Poor Morgan. And then we get to infiltrate the new Ministry of Magic, which is subtle at all in its symbolism.
Yeah. It's quite the ride, I guess.
Yeah. Alrighty then. So, your first thoughts about these two chapters? Any comments?
We're just descending further and further into darkness and mayhem. I mean, you know, nothing's really like on the. There is one thing that could be considered maybe a positive thing, but I don't know if it's quite perceived that way.
Yeah. So let's get into it. Chapter 11, The Bribe. And it starts off with Harry's like, okay, creature escaped a lake full of zombies. He can find Mundungus Fletcher. It'll take hours. But not quite. Creature is gone the whole day. He doesn't come back tomorrow. He doesn't come back the next day.
Yeah.
So clearly, tracking down slipper old Mundungus is not quite as easy even for a house elf with all their magic at their disposal.
Right. Yeah, so he's pretty evasive.
Mm-hmm. And then we get this, and then we also realize that there are Death Eaters starting to watch the house.
Which makes sense. I mean, I feel like they're kind of their place is kind of known where they're, you know, I don't know. I forgot how protected it is.
Protected by the Fidelis Charm. Like, they can't physically see it. Like, you know, they can't get in because of the Fidelis Charm and it being the headquarters of Order of the Phoenix. But because they're in charge of the ministry now, they have access to see Sirius's will and know that this, you know, Harry owns it.
Okay. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. As we find out from Lupin later that, you know, they're basically kind of staking out any place possibly associated with Harry Potter. And if they had known specifically that Harry Potter was there, there would have been a shit ton more of them waiting out there, like vultures roosting in a tree.
So it's just, they're just basically stalking him at his best known places. How lovely.
Mm-hmm. And so, let's see. And let's see, what do we got? We have... Okay, the door creaks open. Okay, so Lupin shows up pretty early in this chapter. Sorry, it's all a blur to me.
No, yes, sorry. There was something that I thought was mentioned before, but it's not mentioned yet. Yes, he does.
Yeah.
Shows up early. Sans Tonks, right? She's not there.
Sans Tonks. And Harry is the only one of the three to, like, ask a security question.
Yes. And, I mean,
again, remember what Dumbledore's security question was?
It was something about some candy, right? Lemon.
No, well, it was something. Like, what is my favorite jam flavor? Which I share my favorite jam flavor with Dumbledore. It is raspberry.
Raspberry. Okay. Yes.
I just
I
accidentally
forgot
bought
that.
an extra jar thinking I didn't have any, but I have an extra full jar. So now I have two jars of raspberry jam.
Plenty of toast. Plenty of toast or brie with jam on top of it. I don't know.
Yeah, or I need a just got some wheat bread, some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Delightful.
Anyway, so we get past security questions and Lupin comes in, they shepherd him into the kitchen, and Lupin does not bring the greatest news. Like, no one's dead.
Right.
Besides who is already killed. But basically we get a sense of, how quickly things have deteriorated.
Yes.
Since or go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so it's like so yeah, Lupin's like, I'd have been here 3 days ago, but I needed to shake off the Death Eater tailing me. And they tell Lupin about the whole Death Eater experience on Tottenham Court Road, and Remus is really worried because it's like, there's no fucking way they should have been able to find you that quickly.
So the Apple tag is still on Harry, as
Well,
suspected.
they ask Remus, is there any possible way the trace could still be on him? And Remus is like, no. And Ron is very smug about that because he's like, I knew it. And so, do you have any further theories? Because this isn't even something that, as being young teenagers, that they're just not fully aware. Even a very seasoned wizard like Lupin, like he has no fucking clue either.
I mean, I guess like I'm gonna stick with okay. The age thing. I mean, he wasn't there for Harry's birth, was he?
No, not that we know of. It could be someone's headcanon. I cannot confirm or deny that. We don't know that.
Okay. I still think it's probably his birthday's off, and maybe he's a
Okay.
little younger, but that's the theory I'm sticking with.
Yep. And so Lupin tells, like, basically, it was a combination of both Death Eaters and Ministry officials that, like, stormed the wedding. And the Ministry and the Death Eaters are justifying like using such excessive force trying to find Harry Potter is because now they're spinning this narrative of they want Harry Potter for questioning because he was, one of the last people to see Albus Dumbledore alive.
Oh God, that's the excuse now. Okay.
Yeah. So that just made me think of, what's going along going Going on a lot right now in our country, in America. I had a note here about propaganda and, carefully constructed narratives.
And what might that an example of that be
Oh, just
recently?
because just 30 minutes ago, before we started recording, I was going down a rabbit hole of I found this one YouTuber who does like a variety of like video essays and analysis, and I went down the rabbit hole of her video about her debunking, her debunking the critics of American Girl because American Girl is trying to be more inclusive. So basically, save our children from American Girl's woke leftist agenda, and
Oh my gosh.
and claiming that this one book that American Girl published, which was about body image,
Okay.
and a book about body image specifically geared towards ages 10 and up. And so she started off her video essay by reciting all these crazy ass tweets of, boycott American Girl, woke leftist agenda. And she was looking at the book. Okay, here's about like loving your body, accepting yourself as you are, accepting disabled bodies. And oh, I don't see it. Where is it? So basically, so for me, just the thinking of, what I think I mentioned a lot of, Mike, in talking to you is the straw man fallacy, where you create a caricature of the opposing side's position so that you can tear down that and argue against that as if it's reality when it's not. And so just the idea of you're crafting a narrative, because again, and I was mentioning before off mic about how it's like I want to give the opposing side credit, and I think I struggle, whether it's book bannings or like abortion or other forms of social issues that I'm passionate about, I really struggle with the balance of when is it appropriate to truly try to engage with the talking points of the opposing side's position in the hopes of convincing them otherwise, or when is it more appropriate to just call them out on this is really what your agenda is, because your whole argument is based on fallacies.
Yeah.
So anyway, so yeah, just the idea of, it's one thing to interpret facts differently. It's another thing where it's like, oh, like, no, that's just not, you're just basing the whole thing off of something that's not true.
I guess I'm just too busy to make those giant leaps about a children's book, but
okay. Yeah, so yeah, like, well, as I said about the book bans, anyone who has not completed like at least a 5-page book report on the book they're trying to ban, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, exactly. So that's just where I got, you know, trying to spin this narrative. And what else is Lupin has said? Here's an interesting tidbit. Lupin says that according to the rumors, they tortured Scrimgeour trying to get him to reveal Harry's location, and he did not give it.
Dang.
So there's this sense of, you know, we didn't like Scrimgeour. I heavily criticized, you know, Scrimgeour for, if he's not willing to negotiate at all with Harry, then he should just be leaving Harry alone, because if he's already decided he's too important or too high up to capitulate to a 17-year-old, then he shouldn't even be trying. So, you know, for all the shit I gave Rufus Scrimgeour, you know, his last act was, you know, not giving up Harry Potter.
Yeah. Yeah, that's admirable. There must be something there other than just, you know, being a pain.
Like, yeah, and it just made me think of the notion of politics, because again, before, I would like to think that back when Rufus Scrimgeour was the head of the Auror office, when he was just like a head of a department and not the Minister of Magic, that he would have been like more practical and more strategic. And like, you know, there's the sense of, you know, when you get in the position of power and there's so many things you have to think of in regards to PR and optics. And of course, we all want to think of ourselves like, oh, I would never like cow down to, you know, just look caring about appearances. But when you're in that type of position, you know, none of us know until we're in that position, like, oh, are we willing to withstand all the crap we're going to get if we don't do exactly what the mob wants at any given moment?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's being idealistic about those things is one thing, but being put in a position is totally different. And yeah, I always think people just need to judge a little less. They don't know how they're going to really react until they're there. So.
Yeah. And so they're disguising Rufus Scrimgeour's death as that he just resigned and he's been replaced by Pious Thickness, who is under the Imperius curse. And Ron is like, you know, why did Voldemort declare himself as Minister of Magic? And clearly Ron has not been privy to the many, many conversations you and I have had about Voldemort not being a political villain.
Right, right. He just doesn't care about that stuff, which, I mean, whatever. But he does put, oh, this is not, okay, the Ministry, sorry. I was jumping ahead. Yeah.
And Lupin describes it as that it's very smart to do, because if Voldemort were to just declare himself, you know, I'm King Shit of Fuck Mountain, then that would have, could have possibly incited open rebellion. Whereas since the coup has happened so, quote unquote, subtly, you know, people are in a position where they highly suspect things, but they don't dare say anything. They don't dare confide in anyone because they don't know who they can trust. They don't, even if someone isn't directly with the Death Eaters or agree with them, they might be imperious to do something against their will. Like, you know, it's just a very shaky environment and everyone's terrified.
Yeah, can't blame them for that.
No. And then what else does Remus have to say? You know, after the wedding, you know, they like interrogated everyone. No one's dead, but they used the Cruciatus curse on Tonks' parents.
Yeah, that's upsetting.
Yeah. And Harry's like, how could they get past all the protections that, you know, they protected me when I was at Tonks' house? And Remus is just like, they have the full power of the Ministry now. They can just they can use whatever magical defenses at their disposal to just crash into anything now.
That's messed up.
Well, it's like you now have access to all the military's arsenal.
Yeah, so then, and, just... That's not good for anybody, really. I guess unless you're a Death Eater, but even they don't really have a good gig either. So,
yep. So, And then we get to the Muggle-born registration.
Oh yeah.
Muggle-born registration. So in essence, you know, recent research undertaken by the Department of Mystery reveals that magic can only be passed from person to person when wizards reproduce. When no proven wizard ancestry exists, therefore, the so-called Muggle-born is likely to have attained their power by theft or force. And obviously, when I was reading this, you know, you can't help but think about all the quasi-pseudoscience that a lot of Nazis in either bribed or coerced various German scientists and academics to create articles and, you know, phony research and shit to justify their notion of eugenics and that the Aryan race is the best race and Jews are a plague on society.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty, this is, I feel like, the most blatant.
Yeah. And it's just interesting because, you know, up until this point, the Department of Mysteries has always been, I guess I always pictured the Department of Mysteries as being super apolitical, even though technically it is housed in the Ministry of Magic. Like, I interpreted that not so much that it's a political entity that has its own, that their research has its own agenda. It's just so secret and what they do is so, what the things they study are so dangerous that it needs the government's protection, you know, to while they research it, like Area 51 or some shit.
I know a couple of things in that.
So we've got this cock and bull theory that somehow Muggleborns are stealing the magic of others, even though they give no possible explanation of how they could possibly be doing this.
Right. That doesn't even make any sense.
It makes as much sense as when Hitler tried to explain that we would have won World War I if not for the Jews.
Yeah. Like, what? Where's the connection? But then people bought it. I mean, there are people, you know, behind him. So.
I think I told you I watched a whole like documentary series both about World War I and World War II, and even a whole documentary series about the interim period between World War I and World War II. And what I really worry about with so much inflation going on right now is I worry we're going to get to such an economic crisis that more and more people are going to buy into crazy shit.
Yeah, that's kind of what tends to happen.
So, and they're just like, Ron is like, people won't let this happen. It is happening, Ron. Muggleborns are being rounded up as we speak.
Oh my gosh.
And it's like, yeah. And it just makes things, you know, people won't let this happen. As I've said probably on this podcast in some capacity, and I'll say it again, I don't think it's a coincidence that on a global scale, this notion of nationalism bordering on fascism has reemerged at a period where the majority of people who personally witnessed World War II are now deceased. So it was only that generation who remembered the horrors of World War II who put in policies to be like, yeah, we don't want to do that again. But now that there's no one who has personally, very few people left who have personally experienced that, we're all about buying into fascism again.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. That's very scary.
Yep. So, and Ron has a very sweet moment where he's like, you're going to be my cousin. I'm going to teach my family tree.
Right,
with
right.
Hermione,
right.
And she's like, "Oh, that's very sweet, but it doesn't matter. We're with the most wanted kid in the country right now."
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like they could both be. Well, and Ron is from a wizarding family, and he's a Harry Potter. So,
you know, obviously we discussed a lot of it, and you know, obviously the most obvious real life comparison is, you know, the Jews in Nazi Germany. But what I also thought about with the Muggle-born registration in the office is what certain states are doing with trans youth. Like, I've watched a few news pieces about literally not even just dealing with social discrimination, like with parents of trans kids, literally, you know, parents of trans kids having to make the decision if they're in Texas to completely uproot themselves and move. And it's not even just moving to like more liberal states. There are only three specific states that have laws in place where Texas would not be able to extradite them, because there are new laws in place about, you know, reporting parents of trans youth to like child protective services for abusing their kids by giving them access to gender affirming healthcare.
Oh my, that's Very
and,
upsetting.
And one of the families, one of the parents that they talked to, she's like, my grandfather was in the French Resistance. My grandmother survived Auschwitz. You know, this is the same shit.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Different ways to hurt each other. I think we can always come up with that.
Yeah. So I think, so yeah, obviously the Jews in Nazi Germany are one, but obviously I was too young or wasn't born yet to witness the discrimination against gays, like in the 80s and 90s with the AIDS, you know, epidemic. But I feel like, you know, what went on then is basically what's happening now with like this hysteria over trans youth. And it's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It's just like, it's in a new cycle of discrimination. It's very annoying. When you win one battle, you have to fight another. So it's kind of exhausting.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, no, I don't want to go into the rabbit hole of She Who Must Not Be Named. Harry Potter wrote these books.
Yeah, there we go.
So let's see. Another tidbit is, you know, attendance is now compulsory at Hogwarts. The majority of kids in Britain go to Hogwarts anyway, but parents still maintain the right to homeschool their children if they wanted to. And that was an interesting tidbit, because obviously it's another means of control to keep tabs on Wizarding society. But that just made me think of, you know, controlling a population via education, because there is actually an uptick in homeschooling on both sides of this political spectrum. There are all the people who are pulling their kids and homeschooling their kids because they don't want no communist indoctrination. And then there's the opposite end where there are, like, you know, parents of color homeschooling their children because they don't want to subject their children to racist bullshit that we still haven't worked through yet.
Yeah. I mean, I have some of my friends are those parents. So that's and that was totally the reason. It's just they don't want the, you know, it's hard to school libraries and accessibility to books, you know, if that's your only kind of place to find something to read, you don't have that problem so much if your mother is taking you to the library and, you know, or father, whatever, no judgment, and letting you read whatever you want. So there we go.
So yeah, so just the homeschooling thing got to me as well, because that is something that, again, technically it's not a political podcast, but I always end up going on rants, because again, the whole point is just the interesting paradox of we read literature to escape, but good literature always has parallels and allegories.
Yeah it does.
Mm-hmm. So and Remus is like, okay, Dumbledore gave you a mission, right? And Harry's like, yeah, can you tell me? No. And Remus is like, that's okay, you don't have to tell me, but I still want to help you. And Harry's like thinking that's a very tempting offer, but Hermione, being the emotionally intelligent one, is like, what about your wife?
Right.
And right. Lupin's like, Tonks will be perfectly safe. She'll be at her parents' house. And Harry's like thinking, you know, she's an Auror. She is part of the Order. Like she's not going to sit tight at her parents' house. And then Remus admits Tonks is pregnant.
Yeah. What? I mean, not that I'm stupid, but like, there was just a lot of complication, I think, with that, isn't there?
Yeah. And Lupin tries to get Harry with a little pulling at his heartstrings, a little emotional blackmail. James would have wanted me to come with you, Harry.
Ugh, that's not fair.
And Harry's
like, then he kind of loses his shit about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, Harry is just like, I'm not convinced of that. I'm pretty sure my father would have wanted to know why you aren't sticking with your own kid, actually.
Yeah.
And Lupin is like, you don't understand. Explain, then, said Harry. And then, quite honestly, Harry starts out pretty calmly.
Yeah. But he obviously hit a nerve with that.
Yeah. And Lupin is like, I made a grave mistake in marrying Tonks. I did it against my better judgment, and I have regretted it very much ever since. I see, said Harry. So you're just going to dump her and the kid and run off with us? And Remus is like, don't you understand what I've done to my wife and unborn child? I should never have married her. I've made her an outcast. Lupin kicked aside the chair he had overturned. So yeah, Lupin's losing his shit.
Yeah, Yeah.
You have only ever seen me amongst the Order under Dumbledore's protection at Hogwarts. You don't know how most of the wizarding world see creatures like me. When they know my affliction, they can barely speak to me. Don't you see what I've done? Even her own family is disgusted by our marriage. What parents want their only daughter to marry a werewolf? So, we met Tonks' parents, and they seem pretty chill people. And especially Andromeda herself comes from having super shitty sisters that are Death Eaters and or married to Death Eaters. So I'm always been very curious about that, whether how much of that is actually true or how much of that is self-loathing and projection.
Huh. Yeah, that's a good, it feels more like the self-loathing, especially his reaction. Also, like, there's a way not to have kids. Lupin, I'm pretty sure, like.
Yeah, that's the thing. Harry's parents had him when they were 20.
Okay, yeah.
In the middle of a war.
I don't know what to say.
There's a pattern, and I get a lot of people's headcanon, mine included, is that, you know, they approach reproductive stuff differently. Not even regardless of like the blood purity stuff. I think maybe the motivation is that their population is so small anyway. Like, my headcanon has always been like, for every wizard there's 10 muggles, so it's like only 10% of the population is magical. And so it's like, yay, babies.
Oh. That's well, what always, about this complication, though, with this situation?
And Lupin's like, and the child. Lupin actually seized handfuls of his own hair. He looked quite deranged.
It shouldn't make me laugh, but yeah. I was like,
my kind don't usually breed. It will be like me. I am convinced of it. How can I forgive myself when I knowingly risk passing on my own condition to an innocent child? And if by some miracle it is not like me, then it will be better off 100 times so without a father of whom it must always be ashamed.
I'm sorry, but shut the fuck up. Like, what a drama queen. This is ridiculous.
This is like, let me play a tune on the world's smallest violin.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm just, I just don't have I don't know. Maybe I'm just like out of tolerance for a lot of stuff today, but I think he's being a little ridiculous about this like, whole thing. I mean, I understand the severity, but come on.
I understand the sentiment, but you know, I think he's probably been bottling this up, and this is his first time he's letting himself have this pity party.
Yeah, this is how it's coming out. Oh my god.
And Remus, whispered Hermione, tears in her eyes. Don't say that. How could anyone be ashamed of you? Oh, I don't know, Hermione, said Harry. I'd be pretty ashamed of him. What'd you think when you heard that?
That was a little intense, but I mean, but I guess I am too. Come on, man, chill.
Yeah, and this, obviously, we understand why this hits a nerve with Harry, because Harry's just like, if the new regime thinks Muggleborns are bad, what will they do to a half-werewolf whose father is in the Order? My father died trying to protect my mother and me, and you reckon he'd tell you to abandon your kid and go on an adventure with us? And,
that's pretty saucy.
Yeah, Lupin's like gone apoplectic. He's like, how dare you? This is not about a desire for danger or personal glory. How dare you suggest, Sesta? I think you're feeling a bit of a daredevil, Harry said. You fancy stepping into Sirius's shoes. Oh, mic drop.
My. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
And I'd never have believed this, said Harry. The man who taught me to fight Dementors. A coward.
Man, and then Lupin drew his wand on Harry. Damn. It's getting intense.
Shoves. Harry flies against the wall, and Lupin storms out again like a drama queen.
I don't know. I'm not really a fan of him in these moments.
I remember first reading this and I was quite surprised that we got this side of Lupin, especially at this point in time. I don't know. Well, again, one criticism I have of the series, I like Lupin. I wish there had been more of Lupin. I'm sure Amanda and Fox the Foxhound would agree with me because she also very much likes Lupin. So yeah, I just remember seeing this and, you know, certainly after, you know, reading the scene and, you know, rereading the series, it really makes you take a step, you know, makes me rethink about all the other previous interactions with Lupin and just how deep his self-loathing, you know, runs and like, reinterpreting everything else you've seen of him in books prior up until that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, because this is quite the different picture of him. I've always kind of assumed he's a little, I mean, level-headed for a werewolf, I guess, but I don't know.
Yeah, because he's always been depicted as the most mature and responsible of all of the friends of his dad, you know, of his dad, right, of Sirius, and certainly of Wormtail. Like, he was always the level-headed one. And, you know, so yeah, it shows, you know, some of his flaws of,
yeah. He's stressed out.
Yeah.
Can't, I mean, it happens.
And Harry wailed, "Hermione, how could you? It was easy," said Harry.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of was. He's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, you shouldn't have said that stuff to Lupin, Ron told Harry. He had it coming to him. Parents, he said, Harry, shouldn't leave their kids unless they've got to.
I mean, he obviously feels very strongly about this.
Yeah. So. And one thing I noticed is that, you know, Lupin loses his shit by Harry calling him a coward, which also mirrors Snape losing his shit when Harry called him a coward as he was fleeing the castle after killing Dumbledore. So we're getting a lot of wizards. We're getting a lot of men in this book series who, where if you call them a coward, like, they lose their shit.
Very sensitive about that. Yeah. Well,
so I'm just trying to think, is there any, like, what is behind that? Because that is that the ultimate in robbing a man of his masculinity by not being brave or not being tough, or I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know.
I would immediately go to that, but I think of it that way because of how anti-trans certain ghostwriters are, or, like, you know, how invested certain ghostwriters are invested in the gender binary.
Yeah. Yeah. But I guess that is perceived as a masculine trait, but I would disagree.
Yeah. And he's like, I know I shouldn't have called him a coward. No, you shouldn't have. And I'm proud of Ron for calling Harry out on this, and it's not just Hermione doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's got to impress Hermione now.
Got to impress Hermione. He's got his fail-safe way to charm witches book.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. But if it makes him go back to Tonks, it'll be worth it, won't it?
Sure. Whatever. Like, I don't know. Like, do what you gotta do, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And then the next section of this chapter is a little bit of Dumbledore's backstory, the Dumbledore family.
By Rita Skeeter, of all people.
By Rita Skeeter, and there's a picture with Dumbledore's family left to right, Albus, Percival, holding newborn Ariana, Kendra, and Aberforth. And he makes a comment about his mother. The mother, Kendra, had jet black hair pulled in a high bun. Her face had a carved quality about it. Harry thought of photos of Native Americans he'd seen as he studied her dark eyes, high cheekbone, and straight nose. Honestly, I think it would have been nice if we had found out that Dumbledore's mom was, like, an indigenous woman. I think that would have been badass.
Yeah, it's a bit interesting, though, isn't it? Because it's, I don't know. I just think that's kind of an interesting thing in the story.
Well, that's one thing people criticize Harry the writer in the story of, like, you know, again, for the time that it's written, not for our standards, not being diverse enough. In fact, I just watched a meme about, like, of a, you know, a parody of, you know, fans or Asian, you know, Asian Harry Potter fans ripping apart, you know, the Cho Chang thing.
Oh, Cho Chang, yeah.
You know, yeah. Cho Chang, and, you know, or the sense of, or again, even like this, you know, making mention of it, possibly, but not quite. So, like, trying to get diversity points, but not quite, but also being able to deny it.
It seems a little, I guess.
There's queer baiting, you know, diversity baiting.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I take it. Because also, it's just, like, in the context, it kind of doesn't really make a lot of sense. I don't know.
Although, if I ever get around to writing my Harry Potter fan fiction, you know, I actually made a point, and I do have an indigenous character who is a Lakota woman.
Well, that makes sense. Is it based in America, or is it based somewhere else?
No, it's a Harry Potter fan fiction. It's, you know, it's based in Hogwarts around all these things, but there are, you know, extenuating circumstances of my personal plot where there's a very specific subset of wizards, and one of them is a Lakota woman.
Well, and yeah, that, and I don't know. I just, this feels... very, it feels like forced diversity, which I don't like. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
But anyway, Kendra Dumbledore's, you know, ethnic roots aside, in essence, Reader Skeeter is suggesting that Ariana was kind of hidden away, basically by the time she was 7 years old, which is when most people tend to, when magical children tend to show signs of magic. And the conjecture she's making is that Ariana was a squib and Kendra, or the Percival or Kendra, you know, didn't want to admit that and just hid Ariana away.
Which is kind of, I mean, this is, we kind of already knew some of this, right? From the drunk aunt at the wedding. She wasn't really drunk, but she was a little mouthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And basically insinuating that the whole move to Godric's Hollow happened when Ariana was 7. So basically just completely, you know, uprooting their life so that they could be very secretive and secluded and no one would have known them.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know.
Yep. And Harry is, of course, very upset by this because he's like, I'm sick of being told, believe. I want the truth, damn it.
Oh my god, don't we all, Harry Potter? Don't we all?
Mm-hmm. But we get distracted from that because finally, Creature has returned with Mundungus Fletcher.
Finally. Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, and then... And at first, Mundungus thinks... He's there to, like, call him out on why did you, like, apparate away? Why did you cause a mad eye to get killed? And he thinks, he's like, I'm no bleeding hero. I never sign up for that. I'm like, we don't care about that.
Right. Creature's getting some props. Yeah. So that's
Creature good, apologizes for the delay in bringing the thief master, croaked the elf. Fletcher knows how to avoid capture, has many hidey holes and accomplices. Nevertheless, Creature cornered the thief in the end.
Good job, Creature.
Yep. And it's like, for your information, none of the rest of us disapparated, said Hermione. Well, you're a bunch of bleeding arrows then, aren't you? But I'm never pretended I was up for killing myself. And then they're like, okay, where's the locket? Yeah. Oh, well, first, before all that, I think Creature hits Mundungus with a frying pan.
He's just trying to follow orders, I guess. I don't know.
And Creature's like,
nobody gave him that order. But
Creature's like, you know, perhaps just one more, Master Harry, for luck.
Oh, goodness.
We need him conscious, Creature, but if he needs persuading, you can do the honors.
Oh, my goodness. Violence. Harry's gone full violence.
And, you know, they're like, the locket, what'd you do with it? Why, asked Mundungus, is it valuable? You've still got it, cried Hermione. But Ron is more insightful. He's like, no, he hasn't. He's wondering whether he should have asked more money for it. Again, Ron is not dumb. Ron can be very perceptive and, you know, shrewd and strategic. That's why he's so good at chess. So why is he so encumbered by patriarchal bullshit?
It also kind of shows demonstrates, you know, he grew up with a family that didn't have a lot of money. So, like, I think Hermione was kind of fine. So he can probably kind of think about something in that capacity where she probably wouldn't.
Oh, yes, you're probably right. I didn't even think about it from the socioeconomic level.
Yeah.
But ultimately, Mundungus says, like, I didn't get anything for it. I basically had to give it away. You know, it was a ministry person who basically blackmailed him. You know, I won't give me this lock and I won't report you. And they're like, you know, what woman? Little woman, bow on top of her head, looked like a toad. So, here we are. The Horcrux, the Locket of Salazar Slytherin, of all people who has it, it's Dolores Umbridge.
Of course it is. She had the show back up.
Yeah, were you surprised? Like, were you surprised that she would show back up?
Not at all. I feel like she kind of was too big of a character, and I had a feeling she'd show up in some capacity, honestly, and I probably have seen a still of her in that looked like it wasn't from a previous movie. I don't know. For some reason, I feel like I've seen her with a wand at some point. I don't know.
Possibly. But, although you're probably right. She is such a big name, especially in terms of the fandom hating her more than like Voldemort sometimes, where, yeah, it makes sense that you would think, okay, she's not just restricted to the fifth book.
No. Yeah. And she's back.
Yeah. She's back, and we move on with chapter 12, Magic is Might. And it's just interesting, or what?
I said, here we go again.
Yeah, and it's interesting the way Harry the Writer, you know, introduces the 12th chapter, because at first it gives kind of the perspective of the Muggles in the area, seeing like where are these crazy guys in black robes just loitering around the neighborhood in between numbers 11 and 13.
That kicked off the satanic panic is what happened. People wondering about, I don't know.
Yeah. What triggered the satanic panic? Was there at least one case? Was there at least one kernel of truth of one crazy outlier case, and that just exploded? Like, what started that? I'm curious now, you know, that you mention it. Because I was a little too young.
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure. I know the West Memphis Three. Like, there was a lot of metal music and stuff like that coming out, and a lot of, like, occult symbolism that kind of happened, and I think people just like were into it, and thus, like, I think, let me back this up. I think whenever there's like a strong, you know, I think that was during the Reagan presidency, right? So there was like some strong Christian, you know, moral, whatever, don't do drugs, don't do whatever. So the kind of counter to that is, you know, occultism, metal music, whatever. So we got to find a way to, blame somebody for the wrongs of the world. So of course it's all these like Satanists and whatnot.
Yeah, that makes sense. I should more about that, because I read all, you know, I tortured myself by reading all those books about Christian nationalism. Yeah, and talking about the moral panic of 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I definitely, the West Memphis Three is kind of like the biggest case, where these two boys, or one boy, I think, was killed. And it turns out they think it was just an incident of child abuse. And then, I don't know, it's a very strange case, but these three guys were in jail forever. Not forever. They got out. Anyway. But there was an instance in Italy where people would like walk around at night in like dark clothes. So that's what it made me think of. And during that time period.
Yeah. Well, at least in Italy, they don't have Santa Claus. They have the Christmas witch, who I think is better for to bring you presents, honestly.
I'm into that. That's pretty cool.
Well, so Grimald Place is substantially cleaner, and Creature is taking care of himself. He's engaging in a little self-care, and he's like, shoes off if you please, Master Harry, and hands washed before dinner.
Wow.
He's basically become like a nice butler.
Yeah. Well, that's fine, I guess.
And again, all for just being nice to him.
Yeah, see, that's all it takes, people.
Yeah, just being nice. Obviously, it's, you know, it's nice that Harry's being nice. It's just that it's a testament to how systemic and how bad this systemic problem with house elves is that just doing the bare minimum gets so much out of Creature in terms of labor and, you know, everything else.
Right. Yeah. Men have used that trick for a long time. Bare minimum.
Yeah. I was thinking about that. I was thinking about something adjacent to that recently, where in terms of course, like with Twilight, with all everyone, you know, decrying like certain, you know, romance, YA romance or adult romance about romanticizing very toxic tendencies. But why are female or any other writers of any gender, why are we fantasizing about, you know, those obsessive, you know, stalkerish behaviors? Is because for a lot of women, their lived experience is that men do barely the bare minimum or ignore you.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, again, not that there aren't problematic elements, but I'm always more interested in, like, yeah, that's true. Why are we romanticizing this? Because we have the opposite. Because we have the opposite problem where no one cares whether we live or die.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's what it is. There's like, you know, we wrote a whole world of fiction about men treating women decently. It is messed up, but yeah. It makes
or,
a lot
again,
of
or romanticizing the opposite because we're trying to desperately overcorrect what is shitty about our real lives.
Yeah.
Anyway. So Harry comes in with news. He's been able to nick a Daily Prophet. And who has been confirmed as the headmaster of Hogwarts?
And this is kind of like Snape, trash ass Snape. And this was kind of hinted at in the beginning of this chapter before too, right? There, somebody was like reading a paper and they just said, Severus Snape. I mean, whatever. This jackleg.
It's just,
why is he the headmaster?
Yeah, why is he the headmaster? Because, you know, if Dumbledore and Dippet, his predecessor, anything to go by, it's usually like the Merlin guy with the hair, the Gandalf. He's the headmaster. Like, Snape is 38 now.
Oh, okay.
He's not even 40, and he's and he gets to be a headmaster. What the hell?
That's not really the position he ever wanted to be, is it? He wanted to be like...
No, he only ever wanted, at least as far as we know, he only ever wanted to be the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher.
I guess who's teaching it now? We don't know yet.
Oh, we do. Yes, we do know. So
Amicus.
Yeah, so the Caro siblings, where Amicus is teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts, and Alecto, his sister, is teaching Muggle studies.
I don't know those people.
Yeah, they are relatively new Death Eaters, as Harry mentions. Like, they were with Draco on top of the astronomy tower.
Oh, yeah.
They weren't with Lucius at the Ministry, but they were in the Half Blood Prince.
Okay. Yeah, I forgot that he mentions that they saw them.
Yeah, and they're just speculating, like, what are the teachers gonna do? And it's like, honestly, you know, they might just stay to attempt to protect the students from the worst of it. Which again, that's always. You know, that is an interesting ethical dilemma. Like, when you're in a system you don't wholly agree with, like, do you resign on principle and then nothing gets changed? Or do you try and stay to, like, mitigate the bad circumstances? But, yeah.
I don't know. That's a complicated thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Creature apparently makes a very good French onion soup.
Yeah, we all have our talents. I do not. I don't even know how to do that. So.
Yeah, the quality of Creature's cooking had improved dramatically ever since he had been given Regulus's locket. Today's French onion was as good as Harry had ever tasted. Yeah, and then Ron is like, "There." What is it?
I think we've talked about that before. How food tastes better when you're in a better mood.
Oh, yeah.
When you cook, yeah.
There are still a load of Death Eaters watching the house, he told Ron, more than usual. It's like they're hoping we'll march out carrying our school trunks and head off for the Hogwarts Express.
Yeah, it's a little naive to think that that's going to happen.
But. Yeah. Yeah, so I just made a note here because, again, there were obviously a few years between the release of Half-Blood Prince and this book, and there were plenty of people who wrote like full novel-length fan fictions about what the seventh book will be. And quite frankly, when I read those and then I read this, there were some fanfics I preferred better, because in the fanfic Deathly Hallows books, even though in the fanfic book sevens, you know, things hadn't the Ministry hadn't fallen, things had not deteriorated, so things were still like, again, the crazy terrorists, like, you know, committing their atrocities like on the periphery, but at the same time the school was still intact and you could still have, you know, Harry and his misadventures, you know, at Hogwarts. And so, you know, I still honestly kind of prefer that. And so it makes me sad that, yeah, they're not going to the Hogwarts Express. That's what they're supposed to be doing.
Right. Yeah. There is kind of that pattern that's a little missing.
So I think that's ultimately one of my big hang-ups with book seven, is because I was expecting that template so much, and then when I didn't get it, I did not like it. I understand it more, and I forgive it more as I get older. However, but then there were also times where I was like feeling, okay, you know, as we heard from Remus, like things are deteriorating so quickly. If things are deteriorating this so quickly and I don't get my fantasy of another, like, you know, year at Hogwarts, then why isn't Voldemort just massacring Muggles and like taking over the entirety of Britain? Why are they still like maintaining the Statue of Secrecy, you know, if their whole ideology is about wizard superiority? And like, why have they not revealed themselves to the Muggles? But then after doing a few master's degrees in like international, you know, Middle Eastern studies and thinking about international relations, I can now appreciate the fact that even though Voldemort may want to do that, he's not, you know, he still has to consolidate his control over British Wizarding Society. He's not, because it's not just if he reveals that there's magic, he would have the whole rest of the wizarding world coming down right. on him, like, you spilled the beans and now we all have to deal with it. So I have a greater, at first I would get like, be like, okay, why doesn't he just come out and just start killing Muggles and not give a fuck about, you know, keeping the secret? But it's like, oh, because the other countries of the world would come marching on his door, and maybe he doesn't have the resources yet to deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that makes better sense. Just to keep some control and then kind of slowly.
So yeah, so I understand. So even though I understand, like, plot wise, like, I'm not even saying, you know, that there's any plot hole in how this book has, you know, evolved and developed, and it makes sense things have developed the way they have and why they've developed this way and not that way, but still there's that little childish part of me is I wanted them to go back to Hogwarts.
Yeah and it definitely feels like a pattern. I still think it'll come back, right? I mean, it'll make another appearance.
Yeah, so what do we got? So they basically kind of been staking out the entrance of the Ministry of Magic, trying to gather intelligence, because ever since they found out, okay, Umbridge has a locket, therefore we're going to have to infiltrate the ministry.
Yeah.
Oh, what? And then the first thing that that Hermione does when she finds out that the Snape is headmaster, she remembers that Phineas Nigellus Black has a portrait not only in Grimmauld Place, but he also has a portrait in the headmaster's office. And so So she shoves the portrait into her bag so that Snape can't spy on them.
Oh, good thinking.
And Ron is like, good thinking, said Ron, looking impressed. Thank you, smiled Hermione, pulling her soup towards her. So it's like, yeah, Ron, just say thank you.
Right.
Dear male listeners or masculine-leaning listeners, saying thank you helps a lot. Saying please and thank
you. Exactly. Yeah, really does. Makes a difference.
Okay. And then... So yeah, and then Hermione and Ron are bickering about, why didn't you tell us the magical maintenance people wear navy robes? We have to know all these details, you moron!
Dang, yeah. Come on, get it together.
And she's like, we still have to scout out, we have to do this. And Harry's like, I think we should do it tomorrow.
No time like a present.
Yeah. They're not going to get any more prepared. And yep. So it's just like, you know, we're just going to waste more. If we just waste more and more time, there's more opportunity for Umbridge to have done something with the locket, to have gotten rid of it in some capacity, or trade it, or sell it, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah,
because what would that be if they go infiltrate the ministry and she doesn't even have it anymore?
I mean, they'd probably be SOL, but I guess it's a risk they're willing to take.
Yep. And then, let's see. So yeah, they agree they'll do it. They'll do it tomorrow, even though they're not thrilled about it. And Harry gets another vision.
Oh yeah, and Hermione freaks out about this, but anyway.
Yeah, so, yeah, do you want to summarize what we get in the vision?
I would like you to do that.
So, basically, Voldemort is on the hunt for Grigorovich.
And this was a name that he heard earlier on, right?
Yeah, this is the German and or Slavic wand maker that made Krum's wand. Yeah. And, you know, okay. Harry knew from another vision that, okay, Voldemort's after Grigorovich. And right. Grigorovich is a wand maker. And Voldemort's like, where is he? And the lady's like, he moved. I don't know where. He's like, the fuck if I know. I don't know where this guy is. And Voldemort proceeds to kill her children. And just...
Why not? Like, let's just destroy the whole thing.
Yeah, why not? And, you know, fine. Again, I really struggle with Hermione lambasting Harry about this.
It's obnoxious. Again, we talked about this last week about her being so critical. And I think we kind of find her reasoning this time a little bit more, that she thinks he never really tried. It's like, come on.
Yeah, and it's just like, you never really tried. And it's like, he was taught by the guy who ended up killing the headmaster.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like, I don't get it, Harry. Do you like having this special connection or relationship? I think that also triggers Harry, not just from the sentimental, like, of course I wouldn't want this, how do you suggest it? But it's very much what Snape said to him once when in one of the occlumency lessons. It's like, oh, maybe you like having this connection, makes you feel important. So it's so Snape said that to him. So I think it was also partially triggered by that.
I agree. I think, she kind of has a fair point. And I know it makes him mad, but it's kind of like, well, why would she not think that? So, can't blame her.
So I've always hated Hermione. And again, occlumency is this super complex, like, this isn't taught at Hogwarts, not even at the, like, NEWT level, the highest level. Like, this is a very obscure branch of magic. Like, you know, there are some things, we have strengths and weaknesses, and it's like, I think Hermione is being really unrealistic in thinking that even with a great teacher, there was always a chance that Harry wasn't going to fully get this.
Right.
Because you can't force, you know, just certain talents.
Right. Right.
And so I feel like she's been obnoxious about that. And she's being unrealistic in the fact that, you know, Harry's talents is, it's also very advanced magic to perform a Patronus. Harry can do that fine. So at this point, Hermione should just be like, okay, the occlumency thing is just not one of our strengths. You know, let's focus on something else.
Right. Yeah. I'd like to see her try it. I mean, she should. And then she might have some empathy for that. I think she probably thinks she could know it and do really well at it right away.
Yeah,
so.
She's coming from a position that if Dumbledore had told me I had to take occlumency's, you know, lessons with Snape, I would just grit my teeth and do it, you know, and suck it up. And, you know, it's, you know, she's projecting her own sense of, you know, again, she's projecting the fact that, oh, Harry just doesn't like Snape and doesn't try it, as if Harry was ever, you know, in a position of power with Snape. Snape always had the power, and it was Snape always being the one being obnoxious.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But anyway, so, and then they all go to bed, and then they get up, and basically they knock out a few people, take Polyjuice potion, and go into the ministry.
Yeah, in disguise, right?
Yeah, in disguise. Like, Hermione is Mathilda Hopkirk.
Yeah.
Harry is, like, Ruckhorn.
Right.
And Ron is, let's see, who is Ron?
Is he under the invisibility cloak, or
does he? None of them are, because they have, because they all have disguises, and then...
Okay.
And then they get into, was this? No, it was just the telephone booth before when Harry went to the ministry, and that's how you got in. But now you have to get in with tokens via the toilet.
Cool. It's gross.
Like, the toilets with the Ministry of Magic now, like the bathroom sink in Chamber of Secrets. What is it with hiding things in the bathroom?
I think that it's a very... I don't remember the word, but very silly attempt at humor. I don't know. I don't think it's that funny.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So, and they're having to do this because there are substantially less people who are now able to directly connect the flu network, like the special green fireplaces. Only the highest level of ministry workers can have that luxury.
Makes sense. Locking it down. Things are trouble.
Yep, and then they go into the atrium, and we talked about how the first statue in the ministry was not the greatest in terms of, you know, all the magical creatures idolizing the witch and wizard as the superior beings, but it was subtle.
Right. Excuse me, yes.
Now we have this witch and wizard on these thrones, and Harry first thinks these thrones are, like, carved out of, like, intricate wood, or at least what looks like wood, only to realize that they are grotesque bodies that make up the shape of the throne.
Why? That's so nasty.
Yeah, Muggles, wizard Hermione, in their rightful place. Come on, let's get going. And it's just interesting. It's an interesting choice of Voldemort and, like, the new Voldemort ministry, because... As Lupin put it, he's being subtle in his coup as a means not to incite open rebellion, you know? So if that was the case, then I feel like this sort of statue is very heavy-handed.
This is very reminiscent. I think there's like the Bitch of Burkow or something who would like use human flesh to make lamps and stuff. I feel like that's a callback to that. So I think it was her. I remember.
Yeah, I know. I don't. That was a long time. Yeah, no. I was just thinking of you. You said that, and I thought of Dark Archives. You know, all the history of the books made out of human skin.
Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And what oh my god, the level of medical malpractice in the 1800s, Jesus Christ.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Dark times. Dark times.
Yep. And Ron
feels very much that.
Yeah. And Ron, the name of the guy Ron is impersonating is Cattermole.
Oh, okay.
And we get Yaxley, and we know Yaxley's a Death Eater from chapter one.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, because
yes,
Snape was talking to him. And Yaxley is just like, you realize I'm on my way downstairs to interrogate your wife, Cattermole. In fact, I'm quite surprised you're not down there holding her hand while she waits, already giving her up as a bad job. Have you? Probably wise, but be sure and marry a pureblood next time.
Jeez, right?
But if my wife was accused of being a mudblood, said Yaxley, not that any woman I married would ever be mistaken for such filth, the head of Department of Magical Law Enforcement needed a job doing, I would make it my priority to do that job, Cattermole, do you understand me? Yes. And Harry, Ron's just like, what am I going to do if I don't turn up my wife? I mean, Cattermole's wife. At least Ron is dedicated to his character.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah, because they play this off in the movies. Like, my wife is downstairs all alone. And Harry's like, Ron, you don't have a wife.
Not yet.
Yep. And then, so yeah, they're in the elevator. People going in and out. Level 2, Department of Magical Law Enforcement. Level 1, Ministry of Magic and Support Staff. And then the Golden Grill slid apart in Hermione gas. Four people stood before them, two of them in deep good conversation, a long-haired wizard wearing magnificent robes of black and gold, and a squat, toad-like witch wearing a velvet bow in her short and in her short hair and clutching a clipboard in her chest. To her chest. Great. We found Umbridge.
Yeah, thank God for that. Not at all.
And cliffhanger, you don't get to read anymore till next week.
Yes, exactly. Well, things are getting very dark at the ministry. Very gross and dark. And why would you want to work with things like that around? I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I think about it for my own fanfiction, but I also think about it in, in just general, the headcanon of the, you know, of the series, like, how were other countries, like, in a diplomatic sense, how are they observing or watching this or, you know, taking people in who are probably fleeing the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone needs to write that fanfic.
Yeah, there we go.
All right. So shall we begin with Gothic Geek Out?
Sure. I think a pretty easy one. You know me, I always focus on the Gothic horror. So the very macabre statue in Ministry. I know that's not, I think, while that doesn't have to be a theme of Gothic, there's usually something that just kind of is unsettling in a Gothic novel, be it something as grotesque as that or, you know, something else. So,
yeah, it's not just the pure imagery of the grotesqueness of the statue that makes it Gothic. It's also its symbolism of the societal hierarchy and suggesting that, you know, magic over muggle. And, you know, the note, Gothic literature has always been, since the late 18th century, has been about critiquing certain social hierarchies. In Anne Radcliffe stuff, it's critiquing the feudal aristocratic system. Like, so it's about critiquing government. It's also critiquing religion, because she was super anti-Catholic. And with things like The Monk by Matthew Lewis, he was super anti-Catholic as well. So, yeah, so it's representing all of those societal hierarchies and structures that Gothic literature for a long has been, you know, if not openly disparaging, at least, you know, making subtle commentary on since for centuries now.
Right, right.
Yeah, what was yours?
It's been one of those days.
Yes.
Mine is actually when Lupin was having his meltdown, the sentiment that he had abandoned his child.
My child. Yes.
Yeah. So, because one of my favorite subset of tropes in Gothic literature is when an abandoned child comes back and gets revenge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What's a good example of that?
I don't know if you read it. I think
tale?
There. What?
13th Tale? A little bit?
A little bit. What I think of specifically is that there was a, you know, I watched a episode of Murdoch Mysteries, and, you know, which is essentially a Canadian Sherlock Holmes about this detective in the late 19th, early 20th century solving mysteries. And one of my favorite episodes of that TV show was the Detective Murdoch goes in to solve a crime about the murdered patriarch of this, you know, manor house. And, you know, and the who ends up being, you know, revealed as having killed this patriarch was the fiance of the patriarch's of the son of the family. But what we didn't realize is that she was in disguise, because that the son's fiance was in fact one of the illegitimate children of the patriarch that came into existence because the patriarch kept raping the maids.
Oh my.
So in essence, she was engaged to her half-brother.
Oh, yikes.
So it came out that, you know, she killed the patriarch of that family out of revenge about what happened to her mother. And so, yeah, just the whole... And whether they directly come back as revenge, but just the whole notion that a child is aborted or abandoned, whether it's they're aborted or killed in some capacity, and then whether it's they survive or their ghost comes back and haunts the manor, like the abandoned child, you know, who is given up because their birth, their existence is too much of an inconvenience and would cause scandal, and so on, all the societal pressures are more important than human life, and, you know, them coming back. It reminds me of the quote, was interesting in Lupin's context, because, well, I'm thinking of two. The first one I thought of is, you know, the quote that if a village doesn't love a child, like, they will burn it down to feel its warmth.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and then there's another quote that if you throw me to the wolves, I will come back leading the pack.
That's pretty badass.
Yeah, pretty badass, especially for Lupin. So yeah, so anyway, and so yeah, so that's just what I thought of, is the notion of, you know, kids being born in really not ideal circumstances, and that causes a whole bunch of problems. Which is why reproductive health care is so important.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yep.
Trickle down.
Alrighty then. And now we move on with Tarot of the Day. And the card I picked at random was the Six of Wands.
All right. No swords this week.
No swords. Yeah. It's been the first time in like a good month where no swords. And I guess it's very appropriate. We get the wands, because a lot of this chapter is about, you know, the policies being put in place are all about favoring the wizards, the wand bearers, as opposed to muggles.
Yeah.
But let's see. The Six of Wands appears when you have reached an important milestone or achieved a significant goal, and you are confident, self-assured, and successful. You harness your strengths and talents to bring about a happy outcome in your endeavors and make it through the chaos of the Five of Wands, minimizing your distractions and focusing on the task at hand. Yes, there were challenges along the way, but you overcame them by concentrating your energies on the one target. This is a hard one, because we don't get any, like, happy resolutions. Like, they do end up talking and getting information out of Mundungus Fletcher, but what answers he gives just spark a whole new dilemma and adventure, right. Misadventure they have to go on.
Yeah, there's not a lot of finale. Well, yeah, that's the only thing that you just mentioned that kind of came to a conclusion.
Yeah, the Six
Otherwise, it
of
feels like a lot of things are starting.
Yeah, the Six of Wands suggested that not only have you achieved your goals, but you're also receiving public acknowledgement for your efforts. You may have recently received an award or claimed recognition from your peers from your work. Okay, if I want to take a kernel of that, the fact that Ron is more appreciative of all of Hermione's efforts rather than just ignoring it and expecting it.
Well, I think that we can go with that because there's not a lot to go on.
Yeah, it's hard to squeeze blood out of this stone.
Yeah.
So let's see. The Six of Wands also encourages you to put yourself out there, to be proud of what you achieved, shout your successes from the rooftop, and set it all out there. Well, I feel like Lupin is doing the antithesis of this. You know,
yeah.
He needs to get off his soapbox.
Yes.
And be like, yeah. Boo-hoo, I'm a werewolf. I made my wife an outcast, blah, blah, blah.
Ugh,
the woman has bubblegum pink punk hair. I don't think she...
I don't... Yeah.
It's... Again, not directly with the... I'm just going on a whole tangent about the Remus and Tonks thing. Because, if anything, in his self-loathing... He's kind of diminishing Tonks's intelligence. He's diminishing her agency. He's clinging to a very warped sense of honor and nobility that is quite archaic and doesn't leave any room for Tonks to decide how she feels about certain things.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably another reason I find that whole situation so problematic. I mean, it takes two to tango, so to speak. But it's like, I don't like, you know, especially in a situation like that, it's like, oh, I did this to her. It's like, come on. You know, I think that.
Yeah, he's consenting. Like his sense of, he's acting as if he seduced her.
Yeah, and he didn't. If
anything,
more...
she was like chasing him with like a stick.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very critical of their relationship.
I wish Remus was embracing some of the sentiments put forth in the Six of Wands, because I think he doesn't do enough of that. And I don't know. Again, but to be fair, like, it's, you know, Tonks can say, like, I don't care, I don't matter. No, it doesn't matter to me, but she's not the one who has lived with, like, the sort of societal isolation that Lupin has. And so, you know, yes, she has agency, but can she truly... Not that Remus should be making that decision for her, but is she making a truly informed decision? Because there's no way she can have had that lived experience.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. So, all right, then let's see if things are slightly better with the Black Moon Astrology card. So I haven't picked one. Let me just pick one at random right now. And I go with, let's see, we already, Leo.
Oh, man. All right.
Leo. My father is a Leo.
I know a lot of Leos.
Well, Harry Potter is a Leo.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, so, you know, fire sign, obviously. The sign of Leo, blah, 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 blah. Proud and strong, those born under the sign of Leo are all about integrity. They are ruled by the sun, which is light and a force we cannot live without. We would be left in darkness. Like the sun, Leos are warm and vital personalities. They intend to make their mark on the world, have a secret wish to be admired, and they want their time on Earth to mean something. Not willing to be another link in the chain, Leos want to stand apart from the rest. Some may be known for their dramatic beauty, while others are clowns, or at least the life of the party. When the Leo card comes out in a reading, expect to be at the center of something and be recognized. It may be to do with awards, a television appearance, at a conference, or a public forum. Your talents are about to be singled out for special recognition. Creativity should be part of that endeavor. This is a time for standing out and making sure you are counted. You are going to be appreciated for your unique qualities. It is about to happen. Your life is soon to be filled with creative fun, optimism, and youthful adventure. Well, goddamn, I wish. What is Remus's sign? I don't even. I okay.
I'm gonna Google it. I don't know.
I'm gonna Google it right now. What is Remus Lupin? It's not Patronus. Zodiac sign. Oh, he's a Gemini.
Oh. Oh. Okay. Well, that's on the nose. Okay.
So, yeah. If anything, the only characters that I feel is embracing this Leo standing out, recognizing your qualities, is Snape getting to be headmaster.
Oh, yeah.
In the most subverted, twisted way.
Yes. Yeah. I think that Harry thinks he's displaying some integrity when he's like chewing Lupin out, but
I think, you know, this very warped notion of honor and that I've tainted Tonks, like that's coming from a certain degree of the narcissism associated with that sort of like self-condescending self-loathing. So if anything, in that way, I feel like Lupin is displaying some of the not so positive qualities of the Leo sign, because a lot of Leos, it's me, 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 me. And certainly Lupin at this point is, it's me, me, me. It's about me, 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 me. My self-loathing. I can't live with myself. Blah, boo, hoo, hoo.
Right. Yeah. Yes, he definitely is portraying that, standing apart from the rest. And you said Snape. That's what I'm fixated on right now.
Or, you know, showcasing your talents. Certainly, I think Creature is doing some, has a little bit of Leo action.
He's making some great French onion soup, so good for him.
And hitting crooks with frying pans.
You know, you gotta do what you gotta do.
Again, that makes me think of that one, like, meme or gif where there's a guy in the South, there's a gator charging at him, he just hits his snout with a frying pan, and he goes away, and it's like, that's so South, that's so tech-centered, such Florida.
I like it. That's funny.
Alrighty then. So I think we squeezed as much blood as we can out of those two.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the swords were a hell of a lot easier.
Yeah.
It was like death, despair, betrayal.
Yeah, it's kind of what the vibe is thus far. So those are more appropriate.
Yep. And now we can finish off the episode with our last exercise, fan fiction time.
Well, thank God we focused on this like forever, because mine was, what if Tonks wasn't pregnant?
Oh, so I guess there's the question of how much of Remus's behavior is being triggered by the pregnancy, or like would simply, you know, him self-loathing and him perceiving that his in-laws hate his guts for their daughter has married a werewolf, she's become a social outcast because of it. You know, I guess it's the question of, would that itself have been enough to, you know, cause Remus to like lose his shit in this way?
Yeah.
My personal feelings is no.
Yeah.
Because even though he feels some of those narcissistically noble, I tainted her, I soiled her. Like, even though he may feel those things, I think he's smart enough to realize that if he were to voice those directly to Tonks, she would like punch him in the face.
Rightfully so.
But because if there's a child involved, then there's something that he can, you know, cling to as I'm protecting the child by withdrawing myself, you know? So like, which it's like, you can speak for yourself, Tonks, but you can't speak for the baby, if you will.
Right. Yeah. I think I don't know, you know, having that.
Cause there are plenty of fanfics out there that talk about like the Remus, Tonks love story behind the scenes, like that are totally canon compliant, like while the kids were at school, and some of them are pretty darn good. And my headcanon is that I think there was while the kids were at school in book five, maybe like Remus and Tonks went out on a date and one of them recognized him as a werewolf and gave Tonks like some terrible shit. It's like, oh, you were whore or something like that.
Dang. Yeah, maybe.
So that's always been my kind of headcanon to justify how volatile this reaction is of Lupin when he's always been portrayed as the most level-headed one.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's justified. I just wondered if they would, I mean, I think Harry's reaction would have been like a little less, you know, he wouldn't have kind of told him to basically F off and go home and take care of his wife.
Yeah, because his is more about, well, yeah, because it's the question of would Harry be triggered as much by, you know, it's, would Harry be triggered in the same way if it was simply spousal abandonment rather than parental abandonment?
I don't think so. I think he's like, I mean, because
if anything, I think without there being a pregnancy, I think Remus would have been more easily able to lie and more easily able to bullshit Harry in, you know, okay, Tonks is an orr, Tonks understands that your mission is important, she wants me to go.
Yeah. 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 Yes. I think that's legit. What was yours this week?
I had one and then I forgot it, so let me just give me a moment because it's been one of those days. Oh my god. I had a good one. What the fuck? Oh my god. I'm just trying. Let me see. Thinking what. Oh, what if for whatever reason, whether he lied or whether he, you know, was able to frame his position in a better light, what if Lupin had stayed and Lupin gone with them to the ministry?
Is there any sort of loophole that, like, he can't drink the Polyjuice potion? Like, do we know how they affected that on?
They actually, you know, there is. You know, Lupin explained that it only works on, like, pure, like, full humans. So, like, Hagrid couldn't take it because he's half giant. So I guess it's the question of what is considered lycanthropy. Is it, it's always been treated very much like a disease, but does that change, like, sorry, I'm just thinking, the vaccine, it changes your DNA.
Yeah.
Having lycanthropy change your like structure of your you know being in such a way where he's not in a position to take Polyjuice? That's one thing to consider.
Yeah, because so,
they would all have to take Polyjuice and he would have to be the one under the invisibility cloak,
right? Yeah.
You know, they have, you know, the only the in the Harry Potter world there's obviously the potion that makes it so that werewolves can retain their consciousness and their minds, you know, so that they don't go rampaging people. What I want is I want there to also be a potion that allows Remus to change at will so they can just have a badass werewolf to attack people when necessary.
Yeah, that's what I thought that would be. I mean, if anything, you could hang out with that in that form, but
It's, you know, talking about Remus, because again, as I've mentioned before, like my fanfic in my head, if I ever get around to writing it, again, focuses around if Harry Potter had a twin sister. And one of the elements of that fanfiction in my head is that in the scrap at the end of Prisoner of Azkaban, when Remus transforms into a werewolf, in my fanfic, you know, there's a point where Daisy, again, Harry Potter's twin sister, she doesn't get bitten and, like, she doesn't transform into a werewolf, but she, you know, protects and, like, you know, tries to protect, you know, all the other kids from him and ends up getting a scar across her face, across her eye, you know, from that encounter. And so I just, and that theme of, you know, from 13 onwards, she has this scar across her face. You know, and so a big part of my fanfic is about the dynamics of her with, because she forgives Lupin, but Lupin hasn't forgiven himself. And so I'm just thinking if my OC was in this, how much more deeper would his self-loathing be knowing that I disfigured my own best friends, one of my best friend's children?
That would be, that's an interesting take, an interesting story.
So anyway, yeah, if I ever break down and just write it, which I may, but I don't know.
Yeah, you should. You should.
Yeah. Well, alrighty then. That's all I've got for tonight. Irving. Thus concludes our episode. And then next time, we get to go over chapters 13 and 14, which are the Muggle-born Registration Commission and the Thief. Yeah, yeah. So, catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mayer Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mayer Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mayer Studios on TikTok, and SophieMayer_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mayer Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMayerStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophie Mayer Studios podcast.